Colts Hidden Killers Investigates. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A guy in a small Maine town says God spoke to him at a pond. That's the origin story. From that, he builds a network of churches, schools, and missions in over 70 countries. Greater Grace World Outreach ran for decades without most people ever hearing about it. Still does. Then in late 2025, a 172-page independent investigation blew the doors off. And what's inside that document says it's bad. Alleged abuse spanning decades, leadership that allegedly looked the other way, a system designed to keep people quiet, allegedly. But before we get into what happened, we need to understand what this place actually is. Alita Galvin was raised inside Greater Grace from the time she was 4 months old, born into the original location in southern Maine where it all started. She hosts the podcast Looking for Grace and has spent years investigating this organization. Our other guest today, you're not going to see on camera if you are watching us, but if you're listening to us, you will hear him. So you won't really notice anything different there, but he's not going to be on camera, just so you know. Our other guest, he's going by the name Oscar. He walked into Greater Grace as an adult, spent years inside, left in 2004, and still lives with the trauma. He's using that pseudonym because even 20 years later, this stuff follows you. One was born into it, one shows it. Both got consumed by it. Welcome you guys to the program. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories here. I want to preface before we get into everything, these are your opinions, these are allegations, and we're going to treat them as such as we have these conversations. Congregations, because we're talking about a church type thing. That's what I go to right away. But Alita, you obviously have a deep, deep, deep dive on this, far, far greater than even what we're going to be doing today on your podcast, Looking for Grace. Alita, I want to start here. You didn't pick this. You were born into it, raised at the exact spot where Carl Stevens started the whole thing. From someone who's never heard of Greater Grace, and I don't think a lot of people have, what did your childhood look like? Did you ever sense something was wrong with this, or was this just the only world that you knew?
So this was the only world that I knew. I was actually born in Massachusetts at their second location, and then my parents moved to Maine when I was 4 months old, where I grew up. And to be honest, outside of what was going on at our home, which with my dad was not great most of the time, my childhood was actually pretty great. We lived at the church property, which was situated in the downtown area of a small New England town. It had formerly belonged to the Catholic Church and had housed the nuns in the chapel for the church. So every now and again, I like to joke that I grew up in a convent, which is sort of true. Our apartment was actually in the portion of the building that had housed the nuns. The property itself, though, was huge. There were lots of families, which meant there were a lot of other kids to play with. We had places to ride our bikes, roller skate, swing, and just run around and play and be kids. Mm-hmm. I even went to public school the first few years of elementary school and then again in high school. And in the middle, I attended a Christian school that rented space at the church property, but wasn't affiliated or run by Greater Grace, just happened to be renting the space. But I will say there was one time as a kid that I remember recognizing that I was different or that I was missing out on something. One of my friends at school had brought in an ET doll to school for show and tell. And all my other classmates were super excited, but I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. And because my classmates' initials were ET, I thought she had named the doll after herself. And everybody looked at me funny when I asked. But outside of that, it really wasn't until a lot later, especially when I returned to public high school my senior year, that I really started to notice the difference between my world and everybody else's world.
I mean, it sounds like that's a world, on the surface, an easy way to saying it is being sheltered from the outside. But I mean, I think it goes a lot deeper than that. And it's similar because we hear a lot of the same things from folks from the Duggar clan, where it's years of childhood that actually are not bad. It's out playing outside. It's being a kid. It's being an old school kid to a certain extent. But at the same point, that's wonderful, But then you also, you kind of miss out on what's going on with society around you. Sheltered is one thing. How would you describe it?
Sheltered is a good word for it. I mean, for a long time, I really didn't know what I was missing out on. I really had no way of knowing.
Yeah. Sheltered. Oscar is with us too. Like I said, you're not going to see him on screen, but you'll hear his voice. Oscar, you walked in, and this is different. You walked in as an adult, whereas Alita was pretty much, you know, kind of born into this, this life. You had your own life, your own mind. Oscar, take us there. What did the early days feel like to you? And when did you first realize the version of this place they showed you really wasn't the real one? Give us an idea of where you were at in life and what brought you in there, and then let's walk into that.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Thanks for having me on. I'll try to be as brief with this as sure. I can be. I had a long history in Christianity going back to my childhood in the Lutheran church. I had gotten more fervent about my faith during later high school and college, and sort of matriculated into more of a Baptist Pentecostal, you know, flow and church life on my own. Went to college, you know, graduated into computing, had a very, very fabulous early career in tech, and got married to a woman I had met in church. That marriage, unfortunately, did not work out. Thankfully, we did not have any children. And I will be honest, trying to function as a divorced person, especially a divorced man who initiated the divorce to save his own sanity, in the evangelical culture is not an easy thing. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal of sort of condemnation you have to swim through. So after my divorce, for about 4 years, I didn't go to church at all. I called them my Renaissance years, from 1990 to 1994. So I investigated a lot of different philosophical ideas and had liberal girlfriends and, kind of embraced all that for a while. And then I came back to my faith, largely due to an old friend, a female who I was secretly in love with, who had never been married. That relationship didn't work out, and a lot of it was around my divorce and, you know, the evangelical culture and teachings around that. So when I initially met Greater Grace, at Alita's church, I attended there with another friend while I was in New England on a business trip. I saw something different. I sensed this grace message, this love that went so far beyond, you know, the legalism that I had experienced around the divorce issue, that I thought, wow, you know, this could be a fresh start for me. And over the following months, I was able, because I worked for a very progressive company that deeply valued me, and I had a long history with them. They had just crossed the $1 billion revenue mark, and I'd kind of been part of developing a lot of the core software that made that work. So they wanted to keep me, you know, along with a lot of other people. I'm not saying I was that special, but they wanted to retain me. And this was the mid-90s. And boy, you just couldn't find, you know, people with the kind of experience I had. It was very difficult. So they allowed me to move to New England and work in Boston. They had an office there, and then ultimately from home up across the line in New Hampshire, close to where the church was in Maine. And so I moved up there and became part of that little church, which was affiliated with Baltimore, with the headquarters where Carl H. Stevens preached. And I made trips down to Baltimore, and eventually after a year, I moved down there. There were more people my age, and it was just a faster pace. You know, even though I had this intense career, so I had to balance those two things. As far as what began to, the red flags for me was just the level of commitment that was kind of expected. You know, if you really embraced the message and had the vision for what the church was all about, which was, you know, world missions and heavy evangelism, discipleship, commitment to really internalizing this message that Stevens had, you know, developed over many decades. And I'll admit, it was an impressive message. I mean, he knew the Bible so well, and he could articulate so many points of view around psychology and human behavior, human sexuality, all of those things. And as for a thinking person like me, I was very drawn to it initially. As far as, you know, the red flags, I can remember, and this was after I'd moved to Baltimore, met the wonderful woman who is now, sorry, my wife of 29 years. She had been a lifelong single woman, missionary in Greater Grace. And she's still, you know, married me and loves and has loved me for 3 decades almost now. So anyway, we're living in Baltimore, and I'm, you know, working 50 hours a week from home, and she was on the church staff in the missions office. And I don't remember the particular topic, but Stevens preached one of his just hardcore barn-burning messages where he used a lot of his famous oratorical vocal inflections and for a sensitive person like me, a thinking person, I realized that, my God, I'm being manipulated. My mind, my heart is being manipulated by this man's rhetoric. And yes, he does have a powerful understanding of Scripture. And yes, he has created all these definitions, and there is a wonderful side of it, but there is this other shoe that dropped. Mm-hmm. So I had to sit with that for a while. I didn't say anything to my wife. And about a week later, and this was unusual, they had a prayer service, a prayer line after Stevens's message and the closing everything. And I went up, and there was there's a lot of pastors in Baltimore because he has a big staff, and we'll get to that later. But I confessed to one of the pastors, I said, I'm having a real hard time with Pastor Stevens' authority. I said, I feel like my heart is really in rebellion. And now I wish I wouldn't have said anything. I wish I would have just sat with it. But my wife comes home 2 or 3 days later, and she says, Pastor approached me at church today in the hall and said, is your husband, is Oscar still with us? You know, and I realized at that point when she shared that with me, yeah, they've got this grapevine going on too. You know, they're kind of figuring out who's with them and who's not. So, mm-hmm.
What, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you made the life choice to move all the way there. You know, something spoke to you, and it sounds like you were intrigued, and you were brought in. This seemed like something was going to be very powerful to you. Yeah. And then you sat with it a little bit longer, and then you saw, okay, maybe this, what was it, a moment of this, maybe I didn't quite see all this? What was the shift, I guess, for you? Were you not able to identify how extreme they may be, or how harsh his rhetoric may be, or his control, as you say it, may be at the beginning, and it took some time to kind of simmer in it, to really feel it? What was the point where you realized, oh, this isn't what I thought it was?
I can't say that there was a single point.
Yeah.
I think my subconscious and unconscious mind was processing some of this, even going back to when I was still up where Alita was before I moved to Baltimore, because Stephen's preaching was broadcast. All the close affiliate churches were listening to his messages and raps, and like the Pastor Brown at the time and up in Maine, he would take Stevens's messages and boil them down, kind of simplify them a little bit, and preach them himself, or preach from them. But trying to answer your question directly, the best way I can say it is I knew what it meant to be wounded by the evangelical culture around one of the, you know, divorce and remarriage is one of the biggest hot button topics in conservative Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, you've covered Gothard quite a bit. Yeah. Go look at his views on
it. Yeah.
And, you know, you'll kind of see how many people have been destroyed over this issue emotionally. So for me, that was always in the back of my mind. It's like, my God, you know, God's grace, what Stevens is preaching must be true, because one of the most amazing women in the entire ministry, this single woman who I'm the only man she's ever loved in her life, she served the ministry until she was almost 40 years old before she made herself, you know, available to God for marriage. And I show up and, you know, we meet each other and
yeah, you're almost, you're feeling like this is almost like a divine intervention, and
exactly.
And yeah, I mean, and it's a, it's kind of the frog in the boiling pot of water to a certain extent.
But let me get to one thing.
Yeah,
I was going to talk about this in one of your later points, but the preemptive damage control. So before I moved up to Southern Maine to the church that Alita's from, that initial year that I spent, I did some discernment. I flew up there two or three times. I flew to Boston and drove up and just spent time with people in the church and the pastor and his wife. We went out to eat. We talked. And they sat me down. I'll never forget, in their living room. They had an apartment in the building where Alita lived. And they looked at me and they said, have you heard of the Martin Report from Christian Research Institute? And I said, no. And they said, that's good, because it's an evil report, and it was done, you know, against the ministry. You know, we're a worldwide evangelizing, soul-winning ministry, and it's an evil report. Please don't read it, you know. Now, this is 1995. The internet was in its infancy. You couldn't just do a, it would have been an Alta Vista search at the time and go find the damn thing online, you know? You were going to have to go do some digging to get your hands on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, other people told me the same thing. So,
yeah, control the information. The investigation here that was recently done into Greater Grace, it talked about Greater Grace having its own language, and it's something that we see in a lot of cults. And that's why I'm interested in, and I'm not calling them a cult. Well, in my opinion, maybe I am, but it's my opinion. When we're talking about different language, we see it in other groups. We see it where transgressions might mean something far lighter than what the actual transgressions were. And insert word here, and it usually is some word that, if you take it outside of the context of that organization, would have a very different meaning, or the weight of it would be very different. Words and phrases refined by, in this case, the founders' teachings. If you used a wrong term, you apparently heard about it immediately. Can you talk to me about that a little bit? What does it do to your head when the group you're in starts telling you that your vocabulary is wrong, that certain words mean this and not that? Give us some insight into how the word salad bar worked with Greater Grace in your
opinion. Alita, do you want to go first? You've got, I think I mailed you my glossary. You got it right there.
Wow.
I have it.
Oh my God.
I have it. All right. The expanded Alita, version.
Explain away.
Oh man. I mean, oh, hang on. Let me just look up one word.
I mean, is it like speaking in code? What are we talking about?
Some of it, yeah.
I mean, just for someone who's not remotely familiar with this, this idea that there's different words, you know, you can kind of get it on certain things, but you got a damn glossary. That's a lot of stuff in there.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just one or two words here. Just explain to me what this is.
So let me just pull out one. Faith rest drills.
In what is it?
It's called faith rest drills.
Faith rest drills. So they're like making up terms, basically.
Correct.
Okay.
The specific application of the word acting in the human spirit through theatric action of God's inner government, being tested in trials of faith to see if we respond in quietness and to see what we reveal during this time. I mean, it's wild.
It's like they took a bunch of words and put them together. It's like corporate speak almost, but for religion.
To a
certain extent, where you get like the memo, like the forward-looking memo of a statement.
Oh, believe me, it's much worse than corporate speak. I lived in that world. It's much worse.
Well, I mean, give me some examples of how this stuff was used in practice, Oscar.
Okay. So, yeah, this goes back to before I even moved up to Maine, when I was on one of those weekend sort of discernment trips. Two of the pastors and their wives in the church wanted to have dinner with me. You know, this is kind of all part of the, you know, the sales job, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they lived in the building where Alita lived. So I went to their apartment and, you know, we'd sat down and we were having this nice dinner. And I remember saying, I was trying to be, you know, complimentary. And I said, this is really a wonderful community you have here. Okay. And, mm-hmm. All of a sudden, everybody gets really quiet. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I said? And then one of the pastors says, well, he goes, that's not really a term we refer to ourselves or we like to focus on here. And, you know, I didn't know anything about their culture. So I said, yeah, you may hear that here too soon.
Yeah.
I said, why not? And he said, because it has connotations of familiarity. He said, like he pointed to the other pastor and his wife. He says, they've never been to our apartment. This is their first time. And we don't want to be familiar with each other. You know, we want to only know each other in Christ and as members of the body, you know? And I just kind of sat and, you know, it really befuddled me. And I don't think community is in the glossary, but that just shows you how deep it's like there's this secret knowledge that goes even beyond the things they publish.
Is it used in your opinion in a way to kind of identify who's part of the group where it's like, if you're using our certain language and you're using it correctly to mean the things that we have assigned it to mean, we know you're one of us versus someone who's might be using it, as you did, I guess there incorrectly, it told them you're not quite part of the circle, at least not yet. I don't know
that that's a formal thing. It's like they're having backroom meetings where they
but that's the outcome essentially.
The essential outcome exactly is that the longer you're in, the more mm-hmm. inculcated you get with the speak, the more you're going to speak the way they speak.
Neat, making up their own language. That's fun. Alita, your father was abusive. The church leaders knew it. Again, this is something that we see so many patterns and cycles when it comes to coercively controlled groups or cults where you have the abuse going on, obviously. And instead of calling authorities or getting real help, they decide, you know what, we're going to handle it in-house because it always works so much better when we do it inside because policing ourselves works so well. They shuffled your family between pastors and told you kids to keep quiet and to honor your father. I mean, how old were you before somebody outside that system told you what was actually happening in your home wasn't okay? Give us this story of how they basically normalized the not normal.
So I was 17. I was almost 18. And just for context, my father was a very talented pianist. Mm-hmm. And so he was very well liked, very well known, very well respected, had traveled and played for a lot of people, including Carl Stevens himself back in the day. But he had significant anger issues and they knew it. And all my life, he would get angry over anything. Like, we never knew what it was going to be. And that particular late spring, early summer, he had gotten angry with me over what I don't really remember. He had pinned me against the refrigerator in our apartment, and he was right in my face screaming at me, which at this point in my life, like, him being physical was new. I don't recall before him being physical with me, but him screaming at me was definitely not new. And so I really didn't think a whole lot of it. I was out a few days later with my boyfriend, and we were in his pickup truck riding down the road. It's hot. I've got a t-shirt on. The sleeve moved and he saw a bruise. I didn't realize that my dad had left circular bruises on my upper arms from pinning me against the fridge. And he saw the bruises and was like, "What is that?" And so, of course, I look and I, my dad got mad the other day and, you know, he held me and he was screaming at me. And I said it like it was no big deal, because to me at this point, it wasn't. He pulled the truck over and asked to look at the other arm. And he just looked at me and he said, "That is completely not normal. And it is not okay that he did that to you." And that's the first time anybody had actually said that, that this is not normal behavior. This is not appropriate behavior. And this cannot continue.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize until much later in life, he actually went and confronted my father and told him straight up he would not be doing that again, or he would report him.
So, I mean, how is it being handled internally there?
Oh, they sent them to different pastors, most of whom were not trained to handle this kind of situation. And to be fair, not only did they not give they didn't do my family any favors. They didn't do my dad any favors either. I mean, they let him go unchecked with all these issues for so long. In the end, he lost out on a lot in terms of relationships with us, with his family, because of his issues that just went untreated and unchecked. And he didn't ever feel like he had to. And why should he? They weren't going to do anything about it because they cared more about his piano playing skills than they did about him as a person, which is really sad when you think about it.
Was it more of a liability, in your opinion, that if it were to come out that he's doing this, it's not only just his piano playing skills, it's a member of our church that's at a higher position that's doing it. It would reflect negatively on on the group as a whole. So let's insulate this. And not that it excuses it by any means, but I don't say you can understand why, but if you're operating from a place of depravity and then not looking out for people, you can understand why that would be the choice they would make. It's not the right one, but if you don't care about the well-being and you're more about image, that's the route someone's going to take. Is this the route that they would take, in your opinion, at that place in time, with other people who maybe didn't have a father that was high up in the ministry who wouldn't look good if this came out? Was this the common practice, in your opinion, when other people would come to church leaders going, "There's a problem here in my family. I'd like help." Is that the MO? Keep it. We're going to control it within here and not let this get out.
Yeah, I agree. I can think of very few instances where I think that they would have actually done the right thing and gotten somebody to actually help or reported something to the authorities. The crazy part about all this, the property we lived at was next door to the police department.
Yeah.
It's not like they'd have to go very far.
I'm just going to throw this in there too. I'm wondering, did they have a nice little connection with the police department? Did they have a good relationship there?
I wouldn't say they had a bad relationship, but I would not say that police department would have done nothing if it had been reported either.
Really?
Actually have a very excellent police department in our town.
I wonder, because sometimes you have the cases where it's like, how come nobody locally is looking at this very close? Oh, surprise, that person just bought the new police cruiser for the department. Things of that nature. And I'm curious what kind of connection may have existed there within that dynamic. We're talking today about the Greater Grace World Outreach. Elite Galvin is with us. She hosts the Looking for Grace podcast. And Oscar is also with us. He's a survivor, a former GGWO member. This is part one. There's more to come. Press subscribe wherever you get podcasts as we continue the conversation. In our next part, we're going to be looking at the silence, how Greater Grace turned its own Bible teaching into weapons against anyone who spoke.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.